Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Coming up on the show today, we have a conversation with Brian Wilson, a Vietnam veteran turned peace activist who lost both legs when he was run over by a U.S. government munitions train during a peaceful protest. You can meet Brian tonight right here in Baltimore at 6 p.m. on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University in Barton Hall, room 117. Right now, let's get you home safe and sound with WEA traffic, and then we'll be right back with our conversation with Brian Wilson. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with someone who I've been looking forward to interviewing for a long time. His name is Brian Wilson. His book is called Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. That's two L's. And a man who served in Vietnam, fought in Vietnam. He served in Vietnam. He was made famous around the world on September 1st, when he was nearly killed when a U.S. munitions train ran over him as he was bearing witness to stop a munitions train going down the tracks. And he's written this huge but readable and fast-readable biography of himself, autobiography, Blood on the Tracks. And Brian, good to have you in the studio.
Welcome. Oh, thanks for having me.
So this is, I know everybody does this because it's part of the book and it's part of your life, but this, that, that what happened to you on September 1st, 1987, this was 20 years after you'd, a little bit more or less.
Less.
Than you, when you served in Vietnam.
Right. 69, I was in Vietnam.
And when you went to Vietnam, you really wanted to go to Vietnam.
Well, I think I was mixed about it. I definitely was a traditional loyal kid who grew up in the McCarthy era, knowing that the communists were everywhere threatening us, both at home and abroad. But by the time I went to Vietnam, I had some questions, only because I had worked at Headquarters Air Force as a lieutenant before I went to Vietnam, and I was really unimpressed with the people I was working with. How much they drank, how much they didn't pay attention to a lot of their work details. It kind of struck me as, and I'm a country boy, so I grew up in a small town.
In New York.
In the upstate New York, farming community. So I'm kind of naive, but but I was beginning questions about the quality of my culture from that experience in Washington, D.C., here in the nation's capital. And I was definitely what at the time you might call a chicken hawk. I very much was a hawk on the war, but I was kind of a chicken in that I wasn't sure I wanted to be a fighter in the war. And I had been drafted out of graduate school, so, and I was would have been happy to stay in graduate school, quite frankly. But when I got drafted, my school deferment didn't work for me. I fell through a loophole. Too complicated to talk about the loophole, but so then I had no philosophical or political reason to not go, and so I joined the Air Force in a 4-year air officer program. And so by the time I did get there, I was a little anxious because they had made me, the Air Force had assigned me to a what they called the new Ranger type squadron to go to Vietnam with 40 men and protect air bases, and went through 12 weeks of what they called Ranger training at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And I wasn't particularly a Ranger type of person, I didn't think. I definitely was an anti-communist person, like almost everybody else I knew. I didn't know beat poets or intellectuals when I grew up. Everybody was kind of rural, conservative, you know, America's the greatest. And
right, so you were for the war, and this is what you had to do, and you just said, okay, I'll go.
But I wasn't a type that wanted to be a Marine.
Right.
Or, you know, I wasn't a rah-rah guy.
Air Force was relatively safe if you weren't flying.
I thought it was going to be safe.
Before we get into what happened to you in Nam, which is a very important, I mean, just, and I really want to talk about it in some detail because it's a pretty amazing story. What's also amazing to me is that, because I remember this vividly, Norman Morrison, the postal worker who immolated himself on the Capitol.
He wasn't a postal worker.
He was
a Quaker.
A Quaker. Yeah. Grew up in your town.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. Norman Morrison. We both graduated from Chautauqua Central High School. He was 7 years older than me, But he was the first Eagle Scout I knew. He dated our neighbor's daughter, Judy Lewis. And so I admired him because he was an Eagle Scout. He was right. He was a good student. And I just thought he was a very model person. And, you know, I didn't know him very well because I was 10 when he was 17. But I saw him all the time and really respected him. And, and then in 1965, November 2nd, 1965, as the Vietnam War was raging, even though most people in this country didn't know much about it yet, including myself, I was in law school here at American University.
No dual degree program, if I remember reading right, right?
I was getting a master's degree in criminology and a law degree. And there was this guy that immolated himself at the Pentagon. Well, I was here in D.C. at the time. And then it took me a few days to realize, well, that's Norman Morrison. My God, he's the guy from Chautauqua, New York. And I thought he must have gone off the deep end, you know. And I don't know if you want me to continue the story.
Well, go ahead, please do.
So I didn't think anything more about it until I was in Vietnam in 1969, and I had turned against the war while I was there as a first lieutenant after witnessing some atrocities. And the base librarian, Binh Tui base librarian near Canto in the Delta, she noticed that I was the only one reading these books on the history of Vietnam that were in the library. Most guys were taping music on these big old reel tapes.
Right.
And I was reading these books because I, all of a sudden, from my what I had witnessed, I knew something was wrong. And I knew that I probably didn't know very much. And so she noticed I was really studying these books on my on the daytime. I was the night security commander at Binh Tui, so at daytime I just decided, you know, I had my own time to work out. And she noticed this, and she invited me to dinner at her family's house in Canto City. And I was a little leery, thinking maybe this is set up or, you know, something, because I was anti-war by this time. And I was the only one I knew that was anti-war around me. And everybody knew I was anti-war because I talked about it all the time. But I was the night security commander, and so people still had to kind of respect me. So I went to, I drove my Jeep. She had to do a map. I went to her family house, and we had this great dinner. Very articulate, educated family. They spoke very conversational English. And we talked about revolution. And they dared, I think, to talk about it because they knew how strongly I had turned against the war, and they were telling me how important it was for people to revolt from outside.
That was amazing.
Forces. Amazing education for me, but I was ready to hear it. And then they broke out a musical instrument and sang a song for me. They sang it in Vietnamese first, and then they sang it in English, and it was an ode to Norman Morrison. And I started crying. He was a hero to the Vietnamese. To the Vietnamese, somebody that immolates himself, like a lot of the Buddhists had done in Vietnam, it's not considered a suicide. It's considered a sacrifice for the truth. And then they showed me a postage stamp that the North Vietnamese government had issued shortly after his immolation, as a picture of it in the book. There's a blow-up picture of that stamp. And I was overwhelmed. They knew nothing of my history with Norman Morrison. And from that point on, Norman became one of my heroes, too. Recognizing that it's a very unusual thing to do in the West, but I, by that time, knew that the war was so incredibly atrocious, so incredibly a kill machine, that I myself started asking the question, what is a proportionate response for a conscious citizen to respond to government behavior that over 11 years in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, 6 million Asians were killed, and that by the U.S. war. That's a figure that averages out to 2,100 human beings every day for 11 years. That's beyond comprehension. So I was beginning to think about, wow, conscience, how do you express conscience, which goes against my teachings, I mean my conditioning. So that was a pretty profound, just a day and a Sunday in Kanto City.
And you were already going through some profound changes, and that just,
yeah,
just kind of
pushed. A lot of stuff was happening very fast, and I was really open then. I was really open. My paradigm collapsed.
I'm sure.
My comfortable paradigm I had all my life collapsed in a matter of minutes, or certainly in a matter of days.
Now, I forget now from when I was reading the book, this incident, this thing with the family, how far away was that from the day you walked in the village and saw those bodies?
Well, I was in the village. I was in five villages in mid-April 1969, and I believe I was in this house in late May. So it was probably 5-6 weeks. But in that 5-6 weeks, I was so lividly anti-war, anti-bombing. All people on the base dreaded seeing me walking around because I represented a traitor.
Right.
And I did my job at night. I was still very conscientious. I was scared. I mean, you know, I was in charge of security of the base, and while I was there, we were attacked probably about 13 times, meaning we were attacked with mortars, and occasionally a zapper squad was trying to penetrate the base. You had to be sharp. You had to be alert. I didn't even drink while I was in Vietnam. I was so anxious. I felt I was over my head, but fortunately I had a good NCO. You know, lieutenants are made by their NCOs, and I had a good one. But I was pretty serious about my work because I wanted to survive. I didn't want anybody to get hurt, and so I was doing it despite the fact that I was so disgusted about the whole war and that I was part of it.
And you tell the story about what happened. You went to this village, and I mean, one that hit me, I know it's one that hit you, obviously, was the when you described coming to this village and seeing all these dead bodies and this
one woman. Yeah. Well, I was asked by the Vietnamese base commander to go to bombing targets and make sure the pilots were hitting their targets. I did not even think about what a target was. But, of course, I realized soon that there were no military targets in Vietnam other than human beings. They did not have military bases. They did not have airplanes. They did not have tanks, certainly not in the south. And he sent a Vietnamese lieutenant with me because I didn't know the little side roads and the rice paddies, and I had no idea where to go. None of these were very far from us, but it took a while because we were on these little elevated paths in the rice paddies into these little villages, which were really settlements of families. And so the first target was a village, an inhabited fishing village. All the other targets I went to that week were similar. They were inhabited, undefended fishing villages in the Mekong Delta, Vinh Long province. And so that first village we walked into we stopped the Jeep, and there was a lot of tall grass kind of between the Jeep and the smoke that was coming up. And the bombing apparently had happened within 45 or 60 minutes prior to us being there. This lieutenant obviously knew when the bombings were happening and where the villages were. As we got through the tall grass, I heard this. I was already hearing this eerie scream, and it was a water buffalo, one of the farm animals, on its side with a big gash in its belly, probably at least 2.5 to 3 feet long, and about a third of its skull missing already, but he's still alive, screaming in pain. And of course, I went into shock. It's just smoke, still smoking. The ruins are, there's no houses left. And I looked to my left, and I saw a sea of bodies, blackened from napalm. And I kind of walked as far as I could before I couldn't walk any further because there were so many bodies. I don't know what I was doing. I think I was just kind of walking with no intention of anything except trying to survive those few seconds. And so I was just walking. Excuse me. And I All of a sudden, I saw this woman lying there with her eyes wide open. I thought this was very strange. She was on her back, and she had been clutching three children. They were all bleeding from bomb shrapnel, I assume, and they were blackened from napalm. Every village was napalmed. They were bombed, and then they were napalmed. Bombed with 500-pound bombs, and then napalmed. Finishes everybody off. I was learning. And I bent over and looked in that woman's eyes. I realized the reason her eyes were so wide open is the eyelids had been burned off with the napalm. And I was crying. I was sobbing. I was gagging. I had a handkerchief over my mouth and nose because the smell was so pungent of burning flesh and lingering napalm. You could even see the droplets were still kind of lingering in the air and the chemical residue of the bombs. And I was just, I was in shock. And I bent over, looked closely in her eyes to see that, I mean, I don't know why I did it. I was in a trance.
Right.
And the Vietnamese lieutenant asked me why I was crying. And I don't know how long it took me to respond, but I responded with a statement that it took me 20 years to understand it. I said, I'm looking at my sister, and this is my extended family. There were probably 100 to 130 bodies, and there were a few people that weren't dead, and you could hear them moaning as they were in the process of dying from their wounds. I just knew this couldn't be right. I thought maybe it was a mistake, but after four more villages that week, I knew it was intentional, deliberate policy. Everything I believed in up to that point, I'd been a very kind of good kid in my town, and I'd gone on to college and graduate school. Everybody liked me.
Shoveled by snow during the winter.
Yeah, I loved the shovel snow. I loved it.
Get up in the morning at 5:30, yes, make sure everybody could get to work.
Yeah, I loved it. It was fun. I know, it was odd, but it was my part of my youth. I loved being in the snow. I loved snow shoeing as well as snow shoveling. At any rate, I kind of knew then that I was on the wrong side. If there are sides, I was on the wrong side. And I thought, if there's an enemy, I'm part of it. There was nobody to talk to. There was nobody to process with. I mean, I thought maybe I was nuts. Should I commit suicide? Or I mean, what? It's like just an overwhelming experience. Well, I did fly at the end of that week after being in five villages. I flew to our intelligence office in Saigon at Thompson Hood Air Base because I just knew this was all rotten, and I wanted to know more about what 7th Air Force was saying in their bombing reports. And so I met with our intelligence officer. He was a captain. And he showed me the bombing reports, and it looked like these reports were of the target areas I'd been the previous week. I mean, I had to surmise that just from looking at the maps and looking at the reports. And the intelligence officer said something very interesting to me. He said, you know, we're perplexed because the reports show various VC units. VC was the derogatory term we used for our enemy, the Viet Cong,
right,
which was in turn was a derogatory term for the National Liberation Front. My commander called them vermin. He was not at my base. He was another base in Vietnam. But when he talked, he said they're vermin. That kind of bothered me, too. I mean, even earlier it had bothered me. So he said these VC units ostensibly have been wiped out, according to the bombing reports. But then we discover several days later these same units that are identified, you know, identifiable units, reappear at another location a few miles away. And we don't know quite what's going on. I said, I know what's going on. I'm not stupid. They're bombing villages to get the body counts up and calling them VC units. And the captain said, Oh, my God, I never thought of that. I said, well, because you haven't talked to anybody that was in those villages. And that's just my destiny. That's my fate. It was an extra duty. It's what I stumbled into. And I said, this is so demonic. I said, I don't know what to do, but I said, at least I'm clear now. It wasn't a mistake. This is intentional. This was Nixon's Vietnamization, spring of 1969, and they had to get the body counts up. They had to get the body. And it was real easy. These are turkey shoots. Bombings at 300, 350 feet, A-37s, midday. No mystery to the pilots as to who they're bombing. And who's in the village in the midday is the women, the elderly, and the children. The men, you know, the younger men, were either in the Arvin or they were in some VC unit hiding somewhere until the day, till the nighttime, or they were further out in the fields working. And so that was the beginning of my. I'm still on the journey that started that week.
And that journey, I thought it was important for us to talk about this journey before we talk about where you've come to. People understand, I think, that what happens to any man or woman or child who lives through war, if their eyes are open, even when their eyes aren't open.
I was 27, too. That was another factor. I'd been in graduate school. I had a master's degree.
You were one of the older ones.
I was one of the older ones, non-lifer. But 27, the brain's a little more developed in terms of assessment and judgment than it is at 18 or 19. That's why they like to get the soldiers at that young age, because you follow orders much easier. Your questioning process is much more muted. I didn't know I had a questioning process, but we all do, of course. It's often muted, but
right.
We live in an insane modern civilization, and you almost have to be in a stupor to not see the disconnects and the fact that industrial civilization is on a collision course with life itself. And I don't know how to deal with it necessarily, but I do think it's important to talk about it.
Before we go to break here, I want to talk about what happened September 1st, 1987. Sure. And then I do want to kind of wander through. Okay, saw that again. Then I do want to kind of wander through the time when you come back from the war and what your notions and ideas are about America and the world and how they develop. Because that was fascinating to me, where you've come to philosophically, politically, spiritually in these last 40 years. But first, to take us a break, I really have to talk about, get people a sense of this. As we talk with Brian Wilson, Blood on the Tracks, is this book. What happened to you September 1st when you were sitting in that lotus position to stop a munitions train in California?
Well, the listener should know at least this when I'm describing this, what happened. I had been studying Reagan's policies in Central America by being in Central America on site, examining what was going on in Nicaragua and Salvador, understanding, the incredible demonic nature of Reagan's policies that were all under the cover of stopping a Soviet beachhead, as Reagan would say, in these poor countries that were our banana republics for a century. So I knew where the weapons were coming from that were going to El Salvador and Nicaragua. They were coming from the conquered California Naval Weapons Station. So we had had a vigil all summer long obstructing the movement of munitions trucks and munitions trains out of that base. People had been arrested all summer, mostly blocking trucks, but occasionally blocking a train. And I watched this all summer. I was a jail support person. So I decided on September 1st, which was the one-year anniversary of a long fast I had participated in the year before with three other veterans on the steps of the Capitol protesting Reagan's policies in Central America. That was a 47-day water-only fast. That started out as open-ended. We stopped at 47 days. So here we were a year later. We take the two other vets and I that decided to go on a 40-day, not open-ended, 40-day water-only fast between the rails. having told the base commander what we were doing in writing, why we were doing it, how long it was going to be, and so forth. Took our position. The first train came at about 10 of 12 that day. There were trains every day moving munitions. A 5-mile-an-hour train. 2 spotters in the front of the locomotive whose job it is to see that the tracks are clear. 5-mile speed limit. I took our position in the tracks, and I woke up 4 days later. I had been run over by the train that was speeding at 17 miles an hour. The other two vets got out of the way, but one didn't completely get out of the way. He jumped straight to the left because, of course, we completely expected the train to stop, as it always had.
Right.
The penalty for blocking the trains was posted on a sign a few feet from our vigil, said a year in prison and a $5,000 fine, so we knew what the consequences were. So I woke up in a hospital thinking I was in a jail cell. I couldn't believe when they told me what had happened. I was all wrapped up like a mummy from head to toe. Did not even know I'd lost my legs at that point. I didn't really know much of anything. I woke up and I was able to talk. My partner at the time, sitting next to my bed, explained I wasn't in a jail cell. I was in a hospital room. The train ran over me. One of the other vets jumped straight up and grabbed a cowcatcher railing and then jumped off. What we found out over the next couple, 3 weeks was the train crew had been ordered not to stop, which was an illegal order, of course. This is a munitions train. It stops for anything on the tracks. There's 350 armed Marines protecting the train on the ground, around the train. They watched us get run over. Marines stood by and just watched. So they ordered us not stop. One of the other vets and I had been investigated, unbeknownst to us, as domestic terrorist suspects. The Navy claimed that they thought we were going to hijack the train. Of course, you can't really hijack a train that's only on 3 miles of track with 350 armed Marines. You don't hijack it. I mean, it's a preposterous idea. But that's what they said. So it was an attempted murder, basically. In my book, several chapters describe the details of this leading up to this point and what happened, what we learned, what happened. It's really just a matter that U.S. policy of crushing people when they stand up for their autonomy and their self-determination around the world, it just was another example of how it came home to me very personally, very viscerally. It didn't slow me down. I mean, you know, I recovered. I mean, I was lucky to recover. I have a huge skull fracture and brain injury, plus missing both legs. And I had 2 broken arms, cracked ribs, and all my ribs on the right side were cracked. My right shoulder was broken. It took me a while to recover, but not more than a few months.
And you tumbled under the train when you got hit.
I was hit, and somehow I have no memory of it. That's the thing. It's amazing. I have no memory for 4 days. It starts about an hour before I get hit, and it goes until September 5th, which was 4 days later. The witnesses, I had 40 witnesses, 40 friends there witnessing it. I said I tumbled like a rag doll.
Under the train.
And they waited until the train got over. Train kept going. FBI said it was accelerating at 17 miles an hour, more than 3 times the speed limit. Now, another interesting thing happened on the day I woke up. 9,000 people showed up at the tracks and ripped up 300 feet of the tracks, just enraged, with shovels, hand tools, and their hands, picks, mauls, shovels in their hands. And the police just had to watch because there was too many people. 9,000 people showed up. Now, they repaired those tracks in the next week or two. But from that point on, for 28 months, day and night, 24 hours a day, every train and every truck was blocked. There was a permanent encampment on the tracks of anywhere from 50 to 200 people at any one point, day and night. And so they wound up in that 28 months arresting, I think, something like 2,100 people. They broke three people's arms in the arrest process. But, you know, you can only do, you can only repress people so much before there's the human archetype of wanting freedom and empathy. They're ancient, and you can repress them with our ideological training to be obedient. But at some point, there's something called human dignity that emerges.
Pardon me. And I think what you learned over that period of time is what we're going to come to next. We've been talking with Brian Wilson, S. Brian Wilson, two L's, has written the book Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, a Vietnam vet who's been a warrior, a pacifist warrior against war since he came home from that war, lost his legs to, as we just told the story, of munitions train that ran over them when they were doing a nonviolent protest against this munitions train. And we're going to take a short break and come right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are still with Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson's book is Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of Brian Wilson. He was nearly killed on September 1st, 1987, which we talked about a minute ago, together here in the air when he was run over by a munitions train. Just an unbelievable thing. If you've seen it in film or witnessed it, or it's just how he survived that, even he doesn't know.
I don't know.
But the coming back, that moment, okay, let's take a little further back to when you came home from Nam, and you had begun to change drastically.
Oh, yeah, I was quite changed, yes. I had a year left to do in the military, and they sent me to Louisiana to be a supply squadron executive officer. It was just where I was going to be the last year. And I wandered into a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship there in Alexandria, Louisiana, and that was my home for the whole year. I never knew people like that. I just didn't know people thought like that. I had been so protected in my little cocoon for so long growing up. It was comfortable, but by now I knew it wasn't true. I mean, it was delusional. And these people were just 15, 20 people. I just loved talking to them, and they validated everything I was about. And I got involved in this whole interracial coalition that was desegregating the schools. I was one of the leaders of that group. I got involved with taking people to Angola prison that weren't able to see their loved ones that were there because they were so poor they couldn't afford the long, arduous bus ride to get to the prison and back home. And I did a series of history lessons on the Vietnam, French and U.S. involvement in Vietnam. I did it in that Unitarian Fellowship 5 weeks. And a lot of people came. And I said, this is the truth. This is what really is happening. And this is what has happened. And so I was just really active. Even though I had to go to my base every day for my 8 hours a day. But I knew I was just marking off the days in the calendar to get out. And that was, in fact, I was married at the time. My wife was a lawyer in legal aid there in Louisiana. As soon as she knew that's where I was going to be, she got a job right away. But that November, I think, in 69, I came back in August. In November 69, Simon and Garfunkel came out with their album Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to that song 5 and 10 times a night for months, sitting in our little living room in our little apartment in Alexandria, Louisiana, crying. It was just the way that song resonated in my cells. And my wife didn't quite understand it, but I wasn't hurting anybody. You know, I was just sitting there over. It was an old record player, you know. Put it back to the beginning, Bridge Over Troubled Waters. And I would just play it. It seemed like I played it for hours. That's one song, and just cried.
Yeah.
Bridge Over Troubled Waters. So,
I mean, people didn't understand a lot of those things unless they understand.
Yeah. So then I finished law school after I got out of the military, passed the bar here in D.C., and discovered that I really wasn't going to be able to practice because I had such contempt for the system and such contempt for authority, including a judge, not a personal judge, just the concept of authority figure on a bench. And I realized that I really couldn't, I probably couldn't obey any authority figure ever again. I could cooperate and be respectful, but I couldn't automatically obey. And I found that to be pretty significant in my life to this point. I'm a good cooperator. I'm a polite person. I'm not an arrogant person. But obedience to me is unnatural and unhealthy. Cooperation is very healthy. Even, you know, mutual respect, even when you don't like somebody, doesn't mean you spend a lot of time with them. But I became basically a Gandhian, committed to nonviolence. And, and it's not natural. I mean, it is probably natural at the deep level, but it certainly wasn't my conditioning.
Right.
So I had to really, I'm still call myself a recovering white male. I'm still learning. Learning about all the assumptions and the privileges that come with being a white male. And, of course, after Vietnam, I know that they had dehumanized me. They had dehumanized me, and I wanted to rehumanize myself.
Which is what this 20-some-year struggle has been.
Yeah.
40-year struggle has been.
Yeah. So I'm still in that process. I'm still unfolding in that process.
And there was this moment when you were working, I think you were already a lawyer, and you were working in the prison.
Right.
And you had this...
I had another kind of
PTSD kind of moment.
Well, in 1981, I was working for a state senator in Massachusetts. I was his aide on prison issues and mental health issues, and I had an ID. I was a lawyer, but I wasn't a practicing lawyer. I wasn't practicing in the courtroom. And he hired me because I had a law background. And I was investigating a lot of prison brutality complaints, especially in Walpole State Prison in Massachusetts. And so one day when I was interviewing prisoners on one of the real maximum security cell blocks there, I forgot which one, cell block 10 or cell block 2, I was at the end of a long day of interviewing, and all of a sudden I heard this commotion down at the far end of the walkway at the entrance to the cell block, and I noticed that two guards had dragged a prisoner out on the walkway, and one guard was stomping him with his boots, and the other one was hitting him with a club. The prisoner was screaming, and in a cell block, a very echoey noise because it's concrete, iron, steel. Well, at that moment, something happened to me that was, I had no idea what it was, but I later, a psychiatrist called it a psychotic flashback. I was in a village in Vietnam. I literally was looking at bodies on the walkway. Not just the guard, not just the prisoner, who by that time had been dragged back into a cell. I was looking at Vietnamese villagers, and I was crying. And that's what I saw. I know some part of my brain knew I had to get to my car in the parking lot because this was not a safe place to be having a complete meltdown. But I staggered off that walkway because I had so many bodies to walk over. And I was bracing myself on the cell doors. These were solid cell doors on this cell block, bracing myself because I was going to fall if I didn't brace myself because it was such a challenge to get over all these bodies. And I did finally get to my car in the parking lot of the prison. I'm sure the guards must have thought, maybe I was drunk or something. I don't know, but I had to go through seven doors to get out to my car. I just sat there for probably an hour and a half at least and just sobbed. And my hands, I remember, were just shaking. I couldn't even grab the steering wheel. My hands were, the first few minutes, I was shaking, trembling. And that's when I became a Vietnam veteran, and there was no getting around it. I had to deal with it. And that was, I understood that the psychic, the soul dimension, the emotional dimensions, these deep cellular memories that I had pretty much not had in my brain needed to be expressed, and they needed to be interpreted, and they needed to be integrated into my journey. Another cost of war, but also in a way it was the beginning of a much more spiritual dimension in mm-hmm. my journey. And so that was in 1981, and I did become, as a result of that, I did become director of a Veterans Outreach Center in Massachusetts for 2 years. I still was pretty functional at the time. I had spent about 6 months recovering from that flashback, and in which I just took a leave of absence and didn't do anything. My mother was sick. I went and visited her, and so, well, I was a director of an outreach center for 2 years in the early 80s, and during that period of time, 12 vets in the area had committed suicide, and I knew 12 Vietnam vets. I knew, wow, this is really heavy stuff. We're living in a lie, and some of us vets just can't adapt to the lie, so we have to forge a new path, and if we're not able to forge that new path, we commit suicide, because you know you're living with all the secrets in you. There's no way to process it. Society doesn't want to hear it. You don't even have a language to express it. And you know that not only was the war a lie, but you now know, or I knew, and a lot of the vets I was meeting knew, that the whole history of our republic was a lie, built on the dispossession of native peoples. We never addressed this. The behavior that we, our ancestors had treated the indigenous people on the lands was probably not much different than how we treated the Vietnamese. And a lot of us talked about that. This is part, we've never addressed this.
Right.
And we're just continuing it generation after generation. So when you have that understanding, there's no way you're going to adapt to the culture, because you know the culture is sick and you don't want to stay sick. So you have to begin developing a new vision. You learn nonviolence. You learn new. You wind up finding teachers, because there are people in this culture that are amazingly aware. But you have to find them, and they become your teachers. And you realize, just like the what we call the Occupy movement today, they're trying to actually create a new, sustainable, healthy society. In a society that's not healthy, that's mm-hmm. not sustainable. And so we vets, some of us knew then, how are we going to do this? Well, some of us, myself, I went to Buddhist temples. I studied Hinduism. I studied Native American spirituality. I didn't become a member of any religion, but I learned a lot from talking and reading about a lot of different traditions that try to make sense out of this long journey of hominids becoming modern humans, and then we become monsters. And I didn't want to be a monster. Who wants to be a monster? But I realized I had become one, because I had been such a well-adjusted young ideal kid growing up to the mores that my society taught me were the proper ways to live. And if you asked anybody that I grew up with, I was they would have been proud. You know, student council, honor society, all-conference athlete, active in my church, Boy Scout, valedictorian in my early school, good student in college. But by following these mores and these rules and being obedient to being a successful person, I'd become a monster. This is what I realized in Vietnam. How could I have obeyed an order to go 9,000 miles from my farming community in upstate New York, Asheville, New York, to participate in destroying other people's farming villages I knew nothing about? It happens all the time. It's been happening for 5,000-6,000 years.
Right, forever.
Well, at least for 5,000 or 6,000 right. years. But it had happened to me. And after Vietnam, that was just, that haunted me. How could a good boy like me, my Sunday school teacher, was quoted in the paper after I was hit by the train. She was tracked down. You know, I had perfect Sunday school attendance for 15 years. Of course, it was involuntary, but I had to go. She said Brian was such an ideal little cooperative boy. We all loved him. Well, there you go. What happens to this ideal little cooperative boy? I follow orders to do something that's diabolical without questioning it. So that's the journey I've been on. I've been trying to understand the archetypes, what Jung calls archetypes, empathy, mutual respect, cooperation, deeply embedded in our visceral memories and our cellular memories, not in our brains, in our bodies. And that is what has helped me understand why I was able, or what, where the response to the Vietnamese lieutenant's question, why are you crying, what's the problem? I said, because I'm looking at my sister. That was a very mysterious statement.
You're not talking about the woman who you saw who,
in Vietnam.
Whose eyes burned open by napalm in the village.
But for years, I thought, where did that come from?
Right, my sister.
Well, I discovered it when I studied archetypes and the history of evolutionary biology and anthropology. That came from within me, because everybody has it. It's just that when I learned to obey the mores of my society to be successful to them, to my peers, my elders, my parents, my church, my school, I had become dehumanized in the big picture, in the deep sense, and it became just absurd to me. How is this so absurd? How can we keep doing it? So my book is about my journey. I had to get the idea of a destination out of the way.
Yep.
Because the journey unfolds on its own, has its own energy. It's anxiety-producing at times because I still kind of want to know what's going to happen. But I don't know what's going to happen because when I got hit by the train on September 1st, 87, I knew we were going to have a photograph. There were five photographers there that day, and as well as a videographer. We were going to have a photograph of a train stopping for three veterans who were saying, you can't move those munitions that are going to go, they're designed to go to kill people in El Salvador, Nicaragua. You can't move those munitions without moving our bodies. You at least have to think about moving our bodies out of the way before you continue moving those weapons. And I thought that was at least a sure photograph. You see, I'm not even in charge of that. Something completely out of the ordinary happened. And so it was kind of a humbling experience about don't attach to outcomes. Stay on the trail. Stay on the path. Let the energy of my intention and my consciousness with the universal consciousness, whatever it's called, whatever it is, it's kind of operating independent of my brain. And so I need to get out of the way of it. And I keep learning it over and over. But it is really, the journey has been very amazing. And my parents, you know, couldn't relate to me. They were embarrassed by me after I became a post-military adult. They couldn't relate. And it was very painful to have my parents reject me, basically, invalidate me. But I couldn't go back. Irreversible knowledge. You can't go back to where you were because you know it's not true. It was a delusion. It was a fantasy. It was a bubble. It was a Disney world.
So you have so what you're wrestling with constantly now is the role that you play, and we can take it to all of us, in this kind of modern Western capitalist world that's been created.
By humans.
And trying to find the essence, the core of what we're supposed to be to get back to it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think obedience is in the way. I think believing in our political structure is in the way. But our archetypes are ancient. They can't be eliminated.
No matter how hard they try.
No matter how hard they try to condition us and brainwash us, those archetypes are in the cellular, almost genetic code of our bodies. And they are so necessary to survive. They didn't develop. These archetypes didn't develop over millions of years just for the hell of it.
Right.
They developed because they enable us to actually live in small, food-sufficient communities in cooperation, working hard, taking responsibility. And yes, there's been aberrations in that over the time, but we know that that's the sustainable model. Without being in fairly small, local, food-sufficient communities, nothing else is sustainable. So we've been living in the blip of oil, the one-century blip of oil. It will not be repeated. The blip will not be repeated. But we developed all our habits, all our thoughts, our values, our obedience, our conveniences, our comforts, at least in the West, in the modern world. Remember, a lot of the world never were the recipients of these conveniences. But we outsourced all the pain and suffering outside the 20% that made up the Eurocentric world. You and I and most people listening grew up in the modern Eurocentric world that we thought of as exceptional, as progress. But the chickens are coming home to roost because it's never been sustainable. And we're producing so many carbon molecules in the air. We're burning carbon to fuel this industrial civilization. Those carbon molecules are accumulating in the atmosphere so intensively now that we might face in the next 20 to 30 years, certainly 50 years, something worse than nuclear winter. I mean, imagine, this is our behavior. We built a weapons system since World War II in the Cold, what we called the Cold War, during which we killed 20, 30 million people during the Cold War. In the third world, we killed them. Fighting the communists, we said. We were building all this military to protect the Western way of life. And it's ironic that the Western way of life itself is killing us. I just find it an absolutely amazing realization. And the reason you can't rule out a radical shift in consciousness fairly rapidly, can't count it in, but you can't rule it out because our survival requires it.
And something's happening with that right now. I mean, things are moving.
Yes, things are moving.
If you said, now we only have a few minutes left, but you said that in your travels around this book, you've visited a lot of the Occupy centers around the country.
And they vary from place to place. It depends a lot on whether the local police and the local politicians support it or don't support it. It depends on how together the local people in the occupied camps are dealing with the drug, alcohol, and violence problem, because we actually live in a society that's full of drugs, alcohol, and violence. And these people know they have to live a different model. They're really clear about it. But if they haven't been able to get a handle on it, those camps start devouring themselves, whether the police come in or not. So it's a very amazing point at which people are realizing, young people, a lot of young people realizing, we got to get our act together. We've got to have a new vision. We know it's got to be horizontal, not vertical. We know we have to cooperate in self-determination processes. We have to talk to each other on the street without living room walls separating us, without television distracting us. We actually have to be engaged with one another on very serious matters of rediscovering what it means to be a human being in community. So it's happening all over the world.
This.
It's been provoked a lot because of neoliberal globalization, which has, of course, made the egregious consequences of capitalism more egregious everywhere. And deep down, people have a yearning for freedom and to be free of repression. But now we know we do it. We do it horizontally. No more leaders. No more politicians. We now have to discover this. And I call it a resurrection of the Neolithic model.
And Brian Wilson, I got to tell you, man, I wish you had another hour here, because where you just left off is where I want to pick up. It's been really great to have you in the studio. A real honor.
Thank you for having me.
Brian's book is Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson.
Available in bookstores.
And you can also meet him tonight at Johns Hopkins University from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Barton Hall Room, 117 on Homewood Campus. And his website will be on our website, at steinershow.org. You can find out how to get the book and get to his website, see what he's writing. Meet him tonight at Johns Hopkins. And Brian Wilson, it's been great to meet you, and thank you, brother, for being in our studios.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.